Good afternoon. 4:44, Sunday afternoon. Reporting in from the fabulous blizzard of 2026. The snowpocalypse, the flurryopolis. Guess we've had about a foot of snow here. Read the reports in the internet newspapers, and they make it sound like it's tornadoes ripping through reality and some form of monster storm that's going to start the next ice age. Actually, it's just kind of snowing very quietly, a little chilly, getting dark, and it's good to be with you as we move through these readings, gently, slowly, patiently working our way backwards through the zodiac to Taurus. We're now up to you, the fixed sign, Leo. In a year of, indeed, a little season, basically between where we are now, with Neptune about to change signs tomorrow, I'm working on, by the way, the 25th, and then Saturn and Uranus and Jupiter, all changing signs, followed by Chiron, which is one of the places I want to start. So Leo is part of the fixed cross. That's the stability and the maximum expression quality of an element, in your case, fire. And the fixed cross also includes Taurus, which is very fixed also. It's very stable. And then also Aquarius, that's very stable. And Scorpio, that's very stable. And they have that, often they have that sense of the only constant is change, but it's a very constant. That always, the next thing dependably happening, very much a fixed quality. And when things happen on your cross, days more important than other things. Now, those things are certainly meaningful. We're going to read a good few of them. But there is really cool stuff happening on the fixed cross. And it is describing your relationship environment, in some ways your specific relationships, and your relationship to your power, to your sense of responsibility, to what you want to be known for, meaning, what you want your reputation to be, but also specifically the things that you aspire to. And there's news on this cross. So let's check in with Pluto in Aquarius. This is a big deal. It's a big deal. Pluto finally changed signs. It was in Capricorn 2008 to 2024. And though, the newscasters weren't saying, oh, by the way, this is about Pluto and Capricorn. Pluto and Capricorn ran the table for 14 years, during which time all you heard about was billionaires, banking, budgets, corporations, endlessly. Pluto has a way of creating a distortion where whatever sign Pluto is in can seem like the only thing that exists. It's not true, but that's just the way that the trends in society go. And in this weird world of public discourse that we're all kind of unwittingly thrust into, everyone being essentially a semi-public figure now. So Leo, where the sun shines, peak of summer. We are in the northern hemisphere, the Leo equivalent in the winter, the peak of winter, as the snow continues to gather, looking like a well over a foot of snow. Aquarius is also a fixed sign, but if Leo is hot and sunny and warm and stable, then Aquarius is cooler, more detached. And unlike Leo, it's more oriented in collective reality, whereas Leo is very much about individuation, and much of your chart describes that individuation this year. It's going to be the running theme throughout your chart, including in the discussion of Pluto in Aquarius. So the seventh place, the opposite sign, therefore opposite house, which for you is Aquarius, and for you is the natural point of integration. Alice Bailey was not the first one to say this, but she certainly emphasized it in the book Esoteric Astrology about when you are kind of possessed of or identify with a sign, in your case Leo, you always think about the opposite sign as well and what your relationship to that is, and often that's going to show up in the form of relationships, like in interactions with other humans and sometimes total environments, and that is Aquarius. And what it does, which is interesting for the seventh, is it takes us right into a group context. Group context. And the group context is partly about the groups themselves, but it's also about the patterns that form in the kind of like social domains of the groups. If you have access to the Aquarius reading, check it out for the diagram. It's a photograph, actually, of the experiment you do in junior high school, where you take a magnet and you put a little piece of plexiglass over the magnet, or glass or something like that, and you get iron filings, which are available in the hardware store, and you sprinkle them on the glass, and then you gently tap on the glass, and the iron filings arrange themselves in the form of the magnetic domains from the magnet that's underneath it. The magnetic domains are completely invisible, but you can see them when you do the iron filings experiment. It's really fascinating because you can see the way the poles of the magnet work. It kind of looks like the Earth. And it reveals that there is this underlying layer where the energy field is influencing things in an invisible way. So if you imagine Aquarius as being a magnet and the people that gather being the magnetic domains, the people arrange themselves in a certain way based on the domains of the underlying magnet. In this case, in our case, in our time in history, the underlying magnet is the total digital environment. Now, it's likely that you would, frankly, rather not give a toss about this, but unfortunately we have all been kind of beached in, wedged in, left behind in this environment where we have to navigate the environment. You know, you can bury your head under the pillow of your bunk, but that doesn't change the fact that your boat is floating around on the ocean, subject to the tides and the weather, the movements of the ocean, and you're floating around on the surface layer of this environment, pretty much at its mercy. You can certainly bury your head. You can get drunk. You have a lot of options, but none of it changes the fact that you're in the environment and you're eventually going to have to navigate your way home. That's our relationship in the digital environment. The magnetic domains experiment, if you can just imagine, you know, translating that experiment into a social context and understand that the magnetic domains are the invisible influence of the digital and the electrical environment. That's why I use the magnet as the thing that revealed the hidden pattern. Because the digital environment is the electrical environment, which is the magnetic environment, because all this stuff is based on at the end of the day, it's based on magnetism. And the magnetism of our electronic environment is completely shaping our social experience. And it's not easy to see what that is. It's not easy to get a grip on that. It's not easy to make sense out of that to the point where at least you could somehow navigate it. It just seems like things are happening, but you don't know why they're happening, which is a big quality of digital. You know, do you catch the algorithm or do you not catch the algorithm? Who tells you how to catch the algorithm, et cetera, et cetera, if you're posting YouTubes? The thing that's changed now in this world that you live in constantly, this social world where you're often looking to connect with one person, but you find yourself in an environment where there are many people, and regardless of who they are, the thing about them that makes it all so interesting is that they are being influenced by these invisible magnetic domains. And what I suggest is that you view your quest as seeing, excuse me, it's getting real dry. And it affects my breathing. Observing the things the people are doing, including specific individuals, and see where that fits the underlying pattern. Always remembering how powerful the underlying pattern is, and that what the people are doing is largely an effect of something deeper. Even though you can't see the something deeper, that's the point. It's the environment. It's invisible. It's having effects that you can only discern in the effects. But most people disconnect the effects from some cause. What I'm suggesting is that the effects you see are arising from some cause. Aristotle called it formal cause. They're arising from some cause that's the cause in the form of that magnet that's underneath everything. Now what happens when Pluto enters? Well, Pluto just is going to start to bend everything around itself. It's going to create a distortion in the environment that I would propose, from your standpoint, might be pretty darn interesting. Because it's, first of all, it's a very strong force. And second, it's finally mixing it up for you for the first time in quite a while, and will give you an organizing principle. There's something finally that you can establish a relationship to and say, okay, that's that. I'm me. What's the relationship between that and me? It will be a number of things, including an individual, including or several individuals, and then group environments, and then understanding the underlying influence of group environments. So what you get is, I think, for having Pluto in the seventh house, you live in a much more interesting world. You get a break from the fixity that can just seem so monotonous in a way, especially with Aquarius. You know, Aquarius, you really want to mix it up. So a couple of more things about Aquarius. And I've said this and written this many times, but I think it can't be said and written enough, and even if that's to make sure that everyone hears it at least twice. The dynamics of Aquarius came out during the 2020 situation. And it's important to study that, to see what these dynamics were. Of course, you can always convince yourself that Fauci was a big hero and told us all that there was going to be a virus, and we stayed home and got injections and everything worked out fine. Let's move on. That's not what happened. The dynamics of Aquarius were very obvious in 2020 and 2021. And here is what they were. Maybe there's more facets. If you can say, and what about that? I'd be very interested in that. But the main ones are the influence of the group over the individual. So remembering that Aquarius is your opposite and integrative sign, Leo is very much about individualism, and Aquarius is very much about collective realities. And the first thing that Aquarius represents is the relationship between the group and the individual. Where does that come from? Well, through a series of revisions of astrology, like kind of working into modern astrology, Aquarius was understood to be the sign of groups, but it's also, anytime you read about it, the sign of distinctly individualistic, potentially iconoclastic people, various different shades of refusenik or of nonconformist and so forth. And so putting all that together, it's like, well, there's your relationship between the individual and the group. Is it about the individual being a weirdo when everybody else says no, you can't do that, we don't wear propeller hats in this company? And then also the sign of the group, well, we've got this relationship between the individual and the group. And if you there are various different experiments done, where one person is the test subject and then the other five people on the committee are they're confederates of the experiment, and they're going to try to convince the person that a sheet of paper with three dots on it really has four dots. Have you read about this experiment? I should really find out the name of the psychologist who invented it. It's really, I think, one of the more brilliant psychological experiments in that it reveals what's going on underneath the scrim of rugged individualism, particularly in us Americans. And so the way the game was played was, the people involved in the experiment, let's imagine there were five and there's six people sitting around a table and only one of them is being tested. And they've got cards with dots on them, big dots, maybe one, maybe five. And someone pretending to lead the experiment says, how many dots are on this? And the other five people look at a card with five dots on it, and they say, there's four dots there. And then it comes to your turn, and you're handed this card with five dots, and the leader of the experiment says, how many dots are on the page? And you've just heard everyone say that there were four, but you're looking at five. Many people will say, there are four dots. This tells you a lot about a lot of things. I can't imagine the dynamic, just barely the dynamic. If I were in that experiment and I had a bunch of people saying there were five dots and there are four and there's clearly five, I would be looking at them like, are you fucking kidding me? Probably laughing at them. Oh, but it's real solemn. It's a psychological experiment going on in a university. The problem is, this is a real hack into what's going on with people. If everyone says, yeah, there's clearly four dots when there's abso-fucking-lutely five dots, and most of them say, all of them say there's four, and you're looking at five, what do you say? Now, you're saying, yeah, clearly I would say there was five, but that's not how the results of this experiment work out, as I have read it. A lot of people are easily convinced to just go along with the consensus view. This is Aquarius. That relationship between the person looking at five dots, seeing five dots, and the other people pretending that there are four, this is the conformity dynamic of Aquarius. You're with me? All right. Then there's like the 12 Angry Men scenario. This is a film from probably around 1950. It's one of the classic films of all time. I don't even know the director. This probably wasn't the day when the producer was the big guy. But anyway, 12 Angry Men is about a situation with a jury where one of the people on the jury thinks that this person everybody wants to convict and send up or get executed, I forget which it is, that they're wrong. They're not seeing the plain evidence for what it is. And it's the story of this one person's struggle with the whole jury, with everyone going. It's kind of the opposite of that experiment, where the person stands up to the group. Ah, very important. This too. Both of these very strong dynamics in 2020, 2021. So we have another view of the individual and the group, and this is focused. It is made visible by Pluto in Aquarius. Third thing. The third thing is the capacity of groups themselves to evolve. This is largely theoretical. The group known as the human race seems to evolve only very, very, very slowly. It's too big of a group to consider an Aquarius group. It's more of a Pisces group. It's a much bigger thing. Aquarius is like, you're in a party and it's you, and then you know maybe 10 people in the room, and then it's a bunch of their friends who you don't know yet, but you know that this new person you don't know knows this person that you do know. That's when you're in Aquarius 11th house type of situation. It's a bit self-selecting, unlike a football game where it's just like everybody's thrown in the bowl. All right. When do groups evolve? We wish that they would. We wish that they would evolve. It would be wonderful. And maybe they do. Maybe it's so slowly that the movement is glacial. I have trouble thinking of examples when groups evolve, when there is really a collective quality where the whole group grows. Usually there's someone kicking and screaming, committed to holding back, committed to all those other people not growing because the growth threatens one individual in the group. We've all seen this in some way. It includes in families, it includes in companies, it includes in bands where half the band wants to make a new sound and half the band wants to keep doing the old sound, and the best bands keep going. You know, they reinvent themselves. That's the best example that I can think of group evolution that it would seem to occur in artistic contexts where a dance troupe has to. The whole group has to evolve for the thing to come together. A baseball, the 1969 Mets, that's an example of group evolution where they went from the basement, basically being in last place and laughing stock, to winning the World Series in 1 year. How did that work? Well, there were very strong individuals in the group, in particular Gil Hodges, the manager, Tom Seaver, one of the great pitchers, both former Marines, had that in common, and they were able to assert a form of both informal and formal leadership. And then one day, and then over the course of 1969, a very exciting year, the New York Mets, this new expansion team in the major leagues, goes from nothing to winning the World Series in 5 games. That was special. That was an example of group evolution. You can find some examples of rock bands that do this, but it's very rare. In my experience, and I've been giving this stand-up comedy act for years, saying, can someone please give me an example of group evolution? And the best I can come up with is the dance company evolves. My Dinner with Andre, one of the great films ever made. It's number one film on my list of films that have changed my life, meaning the way that I think. My Dinner with Andre, be patient, don't start it late. You will see there are some great examples of how groups harmonize and evolve, and that is in a theatrical context. So when I come up with examples, it always seems to be in the like repertory company, theatrical ensemble, rock band, baseball team. There's always some, you know, form of we have to rise to the occasion for this purpose. That's another example of Pluto in Aquarius. This is a concept. The last time Pluto was in Aquarius, the Revolutionary War was being fought in the United States. So we don't, you know, and maybe that there were examples of group evolution in the, you know, the ability to get the Constitution together and to agree to the Declaration of Independence. That would, you know, it didn't, it hasn't turned out very well, but it gets a partial credit, right? So three things: the individual being crushed by the group, the individual standing up to the group, and possibly even influencing the group, 12 Angry Men, and then the group itself evolving as a phenomenon. All of this is right in your relationship house. This is why you're never really in relationship with just one person. And people forget how important it is that the context of their partner's life is one of the most influential things in the entire relationship, which is, who is this person surrounded by? How does one partner feel about the friends of the other partner? Who comes into your life because someone came into your life? We've had a lot of that going on. It was very interesting. So it's important that you always at least consider the individual versus group context when you think about your relationships, and ask yourself, who's having the greater influence? The group on the individual, the individual on the group, and how is that? What's that dynamic? What is that dynamic really? And there are people who are fabulous informal social leaders. I really find them to be a tremendous relief to hang around. I love hanging around, like, let's say, for example, guys who are very influential frat presidents. You would think, well, the last person you'd want to meet, I'd want to hang out with, is a frat president. But it's a certain type of individual who is charismatic and who is able to constructively influence a group of people to be a better group of people, because they just have that je ne sais quoi. That it's a visioning capability, it's a charm, it's a certain kind of persuasiveness, but it's mostly an ability to work with informal social patterns, one of the most important concepts in your entire life and in your relationships. You live and swim and walk and fly and work in a world of informal social patterns that are very important. The formal structures, who is the vice president for, you know, academic affairs, right? That's not actually how the university is run. The vice president for academic affairs is always going to have, in my Wayne's world, it's always going to be a couple of very intelligent, prominent professors who are influencing them. They're the informal social leaders. They're the ones who are the zeitgeist of the campus in a certain way, right? So think about this. And Pluto is going to highlight this. One brief thing regarding the seventh. A couple of centaurs floating around in there. I won't name them, but they are instructing you, guiding you, teaching you to notice who are the humanitarians in your environment and who are the violent and aggressive people. And are there any violent or aggressive people masquerading as humanitarians? The ideal person would be Nelson Mandela as the example of the humanitarian, and then like, you pick your disruptive douchebag for the person who's just making it worse for everyone. Okay, that is that, all that for 30 minutes on one house. That there's a lot of information in one house in the context of that house. While we've done the seventh, let's briefly talk about the first, and then we're going to take a break and talk about Chiron next. So wrote a lot about what's going on in your first house. The most important thing to know about your first house is that you are at the moment packing a lot of punch. You have an enormous amount of energy that you are porting, carrying with you. Wherever you go, you are in possession of a kind of a geothermal tap into the center of the earth, and you can pick up heat and pressure and water and the earth's crust is real thin below you, and then you have access to this geyser. Personally, I think the whole world should run on geothermal power. There's like an infinite amount of it, basically. You don't need to burn anything to have it, but you have that. You have that geothermal power. It's in the form of a point called Vulcanus. Vulcanus becomes very active in the second half of the year when Pluto lines up with Vulcanus, and then Jupiter enters your sign and steps right into that opposition of Vulcanus-Pluto. There's something there that's going to give you access to a big bunch of energy coming up from deep within you, from deep under the ground. And then suddenly this taps into many places. It taps into a social environment through Uranus. It taps into a spiritual environment through Neptune. It taps into this relationship reorientation through Pluto. And then there's other things that come into the picture, including this uncanny ability you'll have to calculate trajectories. How are you going to get from there to there? Well, you will be patient, and you will have the ability to just get it, to be able to tap to track the trajectory from places that seem remote to one another, and where you think, how am I going to do that? How am I going to get this little space probe from this moving rock, the Earth, to that moving rock, this asteroid? Well, there's a way to do it, and you're going to have that skill. So your year is very much there's halftime, and halftime is when Jupiter changes signs on June 30th. And Jupiter has been in your 12th place, a very personal house, in your 12th place for about 7 months. And for about 5 months now, February through the end of June, Jupiter is going to remain in Cancer. It's going to station direct on 10th of March and then clear almost two-thirds of the sign Cancer and go into Leo. And this is the lights coming on. It is mysteries resolved, and the mystery of your like feeling your own gravitas, weight, presence, solar influence in the world. Suddenly you realize how much you've got going for you, how much you've got going on. So be patient. If you can avoid making major decisions till the second half of the year, I will tell you there is no rush. And if you do make decisions, make sure you leave them either A, reversible, or B, expandable. Before Jupiter enters your sign, crosses your hypothetical ascendant, and enters Leo, you want to wait till that's completed its process, because information comes to light, and more than anything, with Jupiter, you get an enhanced sense of your own potential. This is very important to work with, because if you think you're only walking around with 10 marbles in your bag, you're going to act like you've got 10 marbles. If you think you have 100 marbles in your bag, you're going to walk around acting like you've got 100 marbles. Well, you're not going to find out how many marbles you got till Jupiter comes in. You're going to also think that maybe you got less than you got, but you got a lot of marbles. And you're going to find out how many marbles, or they're coming. They'll be delivered. It will come, a second day here. A big bottle of marbles, and that's Jupiter. And then Jupiter focuses, taps into this kind of volcanic, earthy, geothermal fire coming up from you that you may only feel as a kind of a remote potential in a different dimension. And then suddenly Jupiter gets there, and it's like, oh, there's substance. There's resonance, right? It's like you would not hear a string vibrating, but if you put a guitar behind it, you're going to hear it because there's resonance, right? That's why when you pluck a string on an electric guitar, solid by any electric guitar, really, it's not very loud. When you pluck a string on an acoustic guitar, you can hear it across the room. That's simply resonance. And with the electric guitar, the resonance counts, but then the electricity of the pickup and the amplifier becomes the resonance. That's Jupiter arriving in your sign, opposing Pluto, and then in this glorious moment around July 26 or something, making this fabulous grand sextile with all this stuff going on in so many other houses. There's this real sense of like, oh, I've got the missing piece. Not only do I have the missing piece was 51% of stuff missing, and now suddenly I'm realizing, well, I've got, yeah, I got a lot going for me. You do. So now we covered two of the fixed signs. What is ingressed? Aquarius, your seventh. What's ingressing? Leo, your first. And I'm going to take a little break, and we're going to talk about Chiron, what it's doing in your ninth place, Aries, and then what it's going to be doing in your 10th place. Because when you contemplate the 10th, expression of worldly power, reputation, responsibility, governance, executive function, accountability, all the way to the top, in this case you, it's always helpful to contemplate the affairs of the ninth house, ethics, spirituality, self-actualization, one's spiritual or religious path, one's ethical moorings, before we talk about the expression of power in the world. And not for nothing. All this shit we see going on is people jumping into the executive, which is where most of the trouble is coming from, having not done the work of their ethical structure. Their internal structure that involves having a conscience, that involves matters of right and wrong, that matters because you are learning the distinction between belief and understanding. Belief and understanding. Let's go there next. Let's start with Borsisi, and then I'm going to tell you about, just in a way angled for you, all the amazing stuff going on in Aries. Hey, and this starts tomorrow. I'm recording on the very eve of Neptune entering Aries for good, to stay for like the next 14-ish years, and we're right there. I think Neptune right now is at 29 degrees and 59 arc minutes. Next stop, 1 Aries, the Aries point. All right, let's listen to a little bit of the kind of yellow noise symphony from Interstellar. So the new news of 2026 is Chiron entering Taurus. And by new news, I mean that process hasn't really started. yet. Chiron has not gotten to Taurus. We had Uranus that visited Gemini briefly, Saturn and Neptune visited Aries briefly, and other things. But Chiron has not gotten to Taurus yet. And Chiron is a real distinguishing factor, almost always helpful, even if you've got to do some work to extract the help. You will find that you really gain something from the presence of Chiron, particularly moving across Taurus, this solid angle of your chart where you are really able to be steadfast and to express yourself in the world in a way that is both dependable and pleasing to your own senses. It's a very strong aesthetic sense with Taurus, and to your sense of your values of what is right and wrong, so that you can set the example that you need to set for the people around you. All leadership is by example. Everyone teaches and teaches all the time, says A Course in Miracles. And now your role as teacher, as opposed to seeker, is going to start to come into focus with Chiron going across your 10th place. So before your 10th place, there's this whole dog and pony show going on and about to go on, about to ramp up in Aries. Fellow fire sign Aries, the ninth place of Taurus, the ninth place of Leo, it's the 12th place of Taurus, the ninth place of Leo, the ninth is your vision for life. It's also your spiritual path. It is your philosophy of really learning. The ninth is about your relationship to the wider world and the universe. So it's less about the immediate thing, who's in this group, who's in the room, and it's more on a level of, you know, where must I go on this planet to have a real feeling for who I am and who I want to be? What do I really think about the nature of God? Most people are quite uncertain. But you have a way here. That you can think about the nature of existence, the nature of God, all of this, you know, under new, fresh, and immediate transits. In the case of Neptune making its ingress into Aries to stay on Monday, the 26th, and this is spiritualizing. This is saying that essentially, the message of your spiritual life is that to exist is a spiritual phenomenon. How do we forget this? How do we forget that that when you do the proverbial math, that it's kind of impossible that you're here in the form that you're in? Like, you know, I don't know how you got here. You don't know where you came from. You don't know where you're going, but you're here. And that's incredible. Well, most people don't. I get it. You know, you wake up in the morning, you're like, you clear the seeds out of your eyes and uncreak your bones. And it's like, what have I got to do today? But don't forget, it's special that you're here and that you exist. Saturn coming soon. So this becomes a, you might say, practical visionary spirituality. The practical being Saturn and the visionary being Neptune, and a combination of the real and the ideal, the real being Saturn, that which is documented, provable, structured, and the unstructured, imaginary, visionary, ineffable being Neptune, and then you put them together and there's going to be some real synthesis. What's the synthesis? It's the synthesis of who you are. Now, what's so much fun is that, you know, Saturn and Neptune, they're very big players. They're pretty very well established. You could probably talk to any first or second year astrology student and, you know, for an essay question, say, delineate Saturn, delineate Neptune, and give me some examples of them working together. And they would do a fine, most would do a fine job about it. You know, you'd get like, well, Saturn is a structure and it's something that you build. And then Neptune is inherently unstructured and it's, you know, of the nature of water or gas that expands and so forth. And you put the two together and you get something like a lighthouse. You get something like a structure built on the sea that temporarily has the temporarily meaning could be for hundreds of years, has the ability to exist as a structure on the sea and provide a dependable line of sight to home, to land, and so forth. It's easy. But then there's also the whole belief aspect of the Saturn-Neptune conjunction. And it's like, well, you get into some questions of belief, and it happens. It is so... Like the difference between believing Neptune and knowing Saturn, and like maybe you believe it, but you're wrong, and you believe it and you're right, and you know it and you're wrong, and there's all different kinds of ways you can twist and turn and mix and morph the mixology of Saturn and Neptune. But it happens that another point that nobody but me talks about. I love those things. I can say that. Yeah, give me somebody who's got a good lineation of Borysici. Borysici. Reading recommendation, if you like to read, I hope you like to read. It's the ninth house, right? It's good to read the great books. There happens to be a great book that's like really short, and you don't hear that sentence too long. Usually the great book is like, oh, am I going to really read Faust? It's only 1,200 pages. Really? I want to read War and Peace, but how do you read a 1,000-page book? Unless it's The Lord of the Rings, and it's very easy. Borysici comes out of one of these short, great books called Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. 1963 book. The chapter's like a page and a half. It's written in this quick, witty, breezy writing style, and it is hilarious, wickedly funny, brilliant, and devastating all at once. That's the genius of Kurt Vonnegut. And in that book, there's a god called Borysici. It's the sun god. And Borysici, so he's a reference. When you hear the word Borysici, that plugs right into Kurt Vonnegut and Cat's Cradle. And Borysici, the whole theme of Cat's Cradle is essentially where belief meets the truth and all the various ways you can mix and match belief and truth, and including believing things that aren't true, and that's a good thing because it saves you from worrying about things, and then not believing in things that are true because they're too difficult to believe in because they are true and all that. And this is all very sly in Cat's Cradle. It's very subtle the way that it's slipped in. I mean, just the joke of the title of the book, Cat's Cradle, comes from this very famous nuclear scientist, one of the guys that invented the atomic bomb. And he gets a report, a government, a like very important government report. In the days that the report was bound with string, they would knock holes in the sides of the page, and then they had this machine, or some secretary would tie a string in it. But what does he do? He gets the report, and he cuts the string, and he makes a little Cat's Cradle toy, and instead of reading the report, he's playing Cat's Cradle. It's so wickedly funny. And so to me, the whole theme of Cat's Cradle comes up when Borysici shows up somewhere. And this is basically the difference between truth and lies, the difficulty people have between believing something and then knowing something because they believe it, so it's therefore true. Well, I believe it. It's true because I believe it. You know, have you done this lately? I hope not. But if you catch yourself, you can get a good laugh. And then you're like, oh, what actually is true? Maybe there's something. Borysici, right there, right in the mix, in the couple of first degrees of Aries, is going to take transits immediately from Neptune and Saturn. So the whole Neptune-Saturn conjunction is summed up in Borysici. Let's talk about truth and lies. And this is about in Aries in the ninth. Let's talk about the truth and the lies of who I am as a person in the universe and my relationship to things like my higher power. What is that? Just bullshit? Your higher power? Well, people can describe an experience of it. Well, I was sitting and then this wave of inspiration came through and I knew that it was my higher power talking. Well, how the fuck do they know that? Maybe it felt like it. That's a metaphor. Okay. Was their higher power or was it just their mind? Okay. So that's Borsisi in the ninth house. What's the nature of this higher power? Is it even true or is it a belief of some kind? That's the whole puzzle of Borsisi in Kant's Cradle. I could read that book 10 more times. Okay, so, this is really good fodder for a spiritual path. This cuts out all the Zen meditation, the pujas and all this crap, and the gurus and the teachers, and it's like, who am I? And am I who I am because I believe I am who I am? Am I who I am because I actually am that thing? Or in the case of being oneself, does the belief make it real? Or is the belief totally bollocksing and deceptive? Okay, well, let's say real and present awakening going on in the conjunction of Chiron and Eris. I don't really have time to go back and give all the backstory, but you can hear me give this presentation every time I talk about the Chiron-Eris conjunction somewhere. And that too is a figure-ground relationship because Eris represents this figure of individuals, very Aries thing, being turned into little TV tribes. Little TV tribes, the Black Nationalist Movement, the Student Movement, the Environmental Movement, the Midwifery Movement, the Queer Movement, the Women's Movement, the Radical Women's Movement, the Student Movement, and then the American Indian Movement, and the Back to the Land Movement, and the Ecological Movement. This is all going on under the influence of the last Chiron-Eris conjunction in the late 60s and the early 1970s. It starts to come into range around 68, 69. There's a big shift in the society in 68 and 69, and it peaks in 71, 72. And yeah, there's all kinds of shit flying in those years. 68 was a very tragic year. 70, very tragic year for many different reasons. But there's all this tension between individuals and groups, and it's not exactly like the Pluto thing of individuals and groups. In this case, I mean the nature of the individual being flattened into a sort of non-distinct tribal entity, and then Eris, and then Chiron's influence of this urgent need to focus who you are as who you are. This is awakening from a very problematic situation, and we are seeing that awakening happen in the world right now. We are in this very weekend that I am recording this is the weekend that things are coming to a head in Minneapolis, where there will be, I think, we're going to see the most impressive manifestations of Chiron and Eris conjunction in starting in and rippling out in a kind of a waveform from the events in Minneapolis and God's frozen people standing up for what is right and what is true. So this is happening in you, and you might do, as a thought experiment, you might like, is there a historic period that you like some people have a thing for medieval times, and some people have a thing for, you know, Celtic-y times, and some are Wild West type of people and Civil War reenactors and all this stuff. Is there a time prior to the 20th century that you identify with, especially prior to the 20th century? And if possible, prior to the beginning, to 1850. And my question is, who would you be? Let's say, for example, in any type of incarnation or location prior to 1850, would you be? Well, that actually is probably something about who you are in 2026. But you are under the influence of influences and influencers and influences that are either watering that down or taking away your access to it or making it difficult to access. So the drama of Pluto in Aquarius, the threefold drama that I was talking about, individual versus group, group versus individual, individual influencing group, group evolution, all this going on in a different form in Aries, but it's very private, very personal, very interior, and there is, you could kind of form a sentence where the spiritual path is me awakening to who I am and always was. Oh, you mean there's no need to, you know, count little mala beads in that case, or take ayahuasca 60 times. The things they do for enlightenment. And Cassia Urbaniak, one of the few legit women's empowerment teachers, once wrote, I quoted this in one of my articles. She said, when people say they want enlightenment, ninth house thing, what they really want is to be adults. Oh, yo, sister, break it down. All right, next stop. Oh, P.S., sorry, there's always a P.S. Do a quick scan for the unresolved psychological material of your mother and your mother's mother going up the matriarchy. What are their unresolved issues? What are their hang-ups? In what way did your mother try to saddle you with her hang-ups? This goes for men and for women. What is the, as Martha Westcott put it, pretty close to her exact words, the unconscious or unresolved psychological legacy of mother. I say this because things are moving from the 9th to the 10th. And when things are moving from the 9th to the 10th, you get that theme of, ooh, the unresolved psychological legacy of mother starts bubbling to the surface. Make sure you know what comes from her. I'm not saying blame her. I'm just saying that a lot of your stuff is not your stuff. A lot of your stuff has been handed down through the generations, and a bunch of it came from mother. And what she didn't resolve, she kind of was very generous and wrapped it up in a little package and gave it to you on your birthday. Well, maybe you want to open that package and sort it out and say, no, this is not my favorite color. I think this one's your favorite color. You can have those socks back. Oh, this scarf, it's kind of scratchy. It's made from that wool. It's kind of, I prefer, you know, cotton or something like that. Have your scarf back, and plus it's ugly. Unresolved psychological legacy of mother. All right, now to Taurus, 10th place. A lot of juicy stuff here. So the 10th is where you get to be an adult. It involves your actual career, your actual reputation, what you're known for, what you are respected for, your steady, stalwart goals. Taurus, 10th. Taurus, great sign. Taurus is the sign of enduring works. Taurians have it, but where we have Taurus, we have the capacity to engage in enduring works. You have it in your 10th place. Now, all things on Earth are transient. And I was once joking with my friend over at the Bob Dylan organization about one of my favorite things on Earth, which is the Lascaux cave paintings. And all those cave paintings, I've personally got an affinity for Lascaux. In France, they're incredible. It's the most incredible art ever produced. And it was produced like 15,000 years ago. And I said, well, you know, we're going to be listening to Bob Dylan in 15,000 years. We agreed, unlikely. But out of my living room, I've got two of those paintings from the Lascaux Cave. That is enduring work. over the ages. Now, most of us don't get to do that. But relative to the passage of space and time and how transient and temporary things are, you have the ability to produce enduring work and enduring leadership example. And who's coming but your soon-to-be new BFF, Chiron, entering Taurus. And this is a combination of the mantle of leadership, the responsibility of leadership, which is part of the mantle, the ability to reevaluate, refine, and set important, tangible goals. Ooh, what a thing. Chiron in the 10th, and in Taurus, there's an exalted quality. I think that if we're, you know, using terms out of ancient astrology, we've got Chiron exalted in Pisces and Taurus. It was discovered in Taurus, early Taurus. We're about to have the Chiron return of Chiron's discovery. That's in 27, 28. And this is going to be personal to you in your 10th place. It's a 10th is a very personal house. It extends into the public realm. It extends into the governmental realm, the leadership realm, the corporate realm, but it's still very personal. And with Taurus, it's especially personal. You want, you know, if you became CEO of a company, right? Let's imagine you got a big budget, you become CEO of the company, and you call the accounting department and you say, is there like a office decoration budget? The accountant will probably say, yeah, you know, nobody spent any money for 10 years. We've just been accruing each year's budget allocation for office decorating for the last 10 years. Got a lot of money in there. And you'd probably say, great, we're going to make this place beautiful in the way that I think beautiful is, which means like we're going to have wood tables, real furniture. We're going to have house plants. We're going to clean the windows. We're going to get rid of that, whatever that bullshit thing, blocking the light. And we're going to have real lights, going to get rid of these fluorescent lights, and you be very high priority that your leadership include the necessary aesthetics for success. Remember, you want enduring success. You're very likely to get it. So Chiron comes along, and this is a mystery. You know, Chiron hasn't entered Taurus since before it was discovered. It was discovered in Taurus, but that ingress, I think it may have dipped in 76, maybe dipped in 77. We weren't consciously living through that. Well, now we get to consciously live through that. So I like Barbara Hand Clow's description of the 10th, Chiron in the 10th, being about the mantle of power. And the mantle of power is not something that should be thrown around. We're seeing terrible examples of people wielding power. Most of the examples we get are the examples of gross abuse of power. And so with Chiron in the 10th, there's no room for that. Chiron in the 10th insists on the expression of power in integrity. And you know, there's material that's going to come up. It's this family material that's going to come up. Let's briefly visit another earth sign in a vocationally oriented house, that being Capricorn, and what's going on in Capricorn. And I'm putting links to the Family Hunger Games in with all of these. And one of the things we've got going on in society right now is a family hunger game. Is we've got atrocious behavior by the people in power. We have a lot of screw you. I'm going to watch you guys fight over that last loaf of bread for the pleasure of people who, you know, who've been eating sumptuous banquets of, you know, lobster and loin of pork and all this stuff. And then all they can do for entertainment is watch poor people scramble. This is pretty sick. And this is dramatized in what I'm calling the Family Hunger Games pattern, which is a group of four planets. It's explained, I explain it many places. If you're really looking for a good explanation, go straight to the Capricorn reading. But the the caution here is that as you take, as you step into your power, part of the crisis of that power that's going to come up is some family bullshit and the limits that they set on you. So what do you do, for example, if you wanted to be a professional bass player and you were pretty darn good at the bass, playing in three bands when you were in high school, and your parents said, "No, you'll never make any money. You're going to be an accountant, and you fucking hate accounting. We're only paying for school if you go to accounting school." Oh, well, you want to go to school. So then, you know, it gets busy, and then you become an accountant, and then there's not a lot of time to play the bass. And then you wake up one day, and you're 60, 50 years old, and you look back and you say, "Wow, every bass player I know has got steady work, and I was as good as they were." Well, what do you freaking do? So there's going to be some, maybe you do it, but, you know, like, it's different starting at 60 than it is starting at 20, right? So there's going to be some legacy material that you're dealing with in terms of the limits on your bliss that your family put on you, and their kind of fakakta versions of healing, and their completely dismissed, probably distorted notions of what it means to work, as influenced by their parents and great grandparents who lived through the Great Depression, and everything's about the Great Depression, the Great Depression, the Great Depression. What's so great about it? I don't know. But there's going to be a lot of letting go of that legacy. And part of what the Family Hunger Games pattern is doing is suggesting work in the realm of family constellation work. And so one of the things to do is to watch the way the family constellations arise and appear in employment environments. Does that person remind you of your crazy cousin? Does that person remind you of your overbearing sister? Is that person your wacky uncle? Is that person who's always either drunk or hungover at work some other person in the family? And what is the culture of the company around alcohol? If you realize that alcohol is toxic and you're working in a company with a bunch of drinkers who are going out every night and getting shit-faced, it's like you're not going to be very happy. And even if you don't drink any alcohol, you're still being exposed to their mentality, which is not the mentality of sobriety. It's a completely different set of priorities. It's a completely different set of priorities. So what's the influence of alcohol in your environment? And who is the douchiest of the douchebags in that environment? Who is the one who just refuses to have any concept of right and wrong whatsoever? And what is that person's influence on the whole place? You're going to be in a position of leadership with Chiron and Taurus. It's going to fade in slowly. It's going to evolve in slowly. And you're going to find out that you really are this person. That the true you is some form of, you know, exemplar leader. Leader by example, and it's not just, you know, you're not just interested in the bottom line and what the shareholders think. You want an office where people are actually comfortable and where they actually can feel good. And part of that's going to be just sifting through a lot of family mishigas and a lot of negative family influences, and like realizing, you know, it's like group therapy. Like, oh, that person reminds me of my brother. That person reminds me of my father. But it's not my father. It's not my brother. And you can just say to yourself quietly, well, that person is not my brother. That wench in HR, she's not my mother. It takes away a lot of power that these people have. Look, you know, there's so much more, but I've said quite a bit. I will sum up Uranus as very exciting, social ideas, experiments, but always keep your ears on, as they say down in Australia. Listen. Notice what is influencing everyone all at once. All right, signing off. 5:58 p.m. Lots of love. And bye for now.